Hi, this is Jen Zaman, and you are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Elise. First, host Teresa Wilkie talks with Jen Hodge of Moms Demand Action about their Be Smart gun safety program and how you can get involved. They will talk about the five steps you should take to make sure your household is safe when a gun is present. Then we air a 2018 interview when host Jeff Humfeld spoke to Ricky Kidd as he was going on 22 years incarceration for a crime he did not commit. Ricky spoke about his struggle with the unfairness of his conviction and how he found his talents as a leader and an artist. Stay tuned for the calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast and the 420 drug war news at the end of the broadcast. We want to thank last week's engineer, Bill Claus, and today's engineer, Keith Washburn.
Good morning. It's Teresa Wilkie. Thank you for listening to Jaws of Justice. We're lucky today. I've got a guest, live guest, Jen Hodge. Hi, Jen. You want to?
Hi, guys.
And she works, she works with Be Smart. And that is an organization about gun safety, and it's a national organization. Isn't that true,
yes,
Jen?
Yes, it is.
So I met you at the Wyandotte County Night Out Against Crime several months ago.
Right.
And it's so interesting, your program and your organization. Do you want to tell our listeners about Be Smart?
So Be Smart is a campaign aimed at adults, but to keep kids safe from guns in the home and in the community. We just know that there are a lot of kids that live in homes that have unsecured guns, and we would like to change that number a little bit. So currently 4.6 million kids live in homes with loaded and unlocked guns, and most of those kids know where those guns are stored. So that's a pretty scary proposition when there's kids dying every day from gun violence in this country.
So 4.6 million live in homes with unsecured guns, and how many kids are there?
You know,
probably 12 million, wouldn't you guess?
So, yeah, I would guess. I haven't done the research on how many kids there are in the United States.
But it's a sizable percent,
right,
of people have guns in their homes and in their cars.
Correct.
So anyone can play along with us. I'm looking at your website, besmartforkids.org. And this organization, is it in Kansas City or is it a national organization?
This is a national organization. We have local chapters in specifically in Kansas. We have Johnson County, Douglas County, out in Salina, out in Topeka, Emporia, all over the state, basically. And then in Missouri, there are several organizations that represent the Be Smart organization in Kansas City Metro, in the Northland, further east, out by Odessa. So I know there's lots of different organizations that support this message.
And then this is a branch of Moms Demand Action, or it is Moms Demand Action.
Yes, all of our volunteers are with Moms Demand Action. However, this is our non-political educational portion of Moms Demand Action. We don't talk about politics and we don't talk about legislation in our group.
And it's important to note, in case anybody listening has not been to a Moms Demand meeting, but there's no requirement to be a mom to attend and to join.
Absolutely,
so,
yes.
Yes. And it's a great organization. There's a lot of fire behind your movement. Now, when did it begin?
So Moms Demand Action began after the Sandy Hook shooting in 2012. Our founder, Shannon Watts, was a stay-at-home mom, and she was one of those people who asked herself, what can be done and who's going to do it? And then after Sandy Hook, she realized,
it's me.
I need to do it.
Yeah.
So she started this grassroots effort basically on Facebook at her kitchen counter, and she has a book called I just drew a blank on the name of her book, but she has a book that talks about how she formed this grassroots movement and how she started it and how to get the momentum going in your own organization or within Moms Demand Action.
So we're coming up on the anniversary of Sandy Hook. You want to tell our listeners when that is?
So Sandy Hook happened on December 14th, 2012, and was kind of my reason for joining Moms Demand Action too, although I didn't actually join until after Parkland because I had just had a baby in May the year before May 2012 before Sandy Hook happened, and my birthday is actually December 14th. So that was my impetus for wanting to become involved, and I always convinced myself, much like Shannon Watts did, somebody else is going to take care of this, until I realized that I needed to be part of the movement as well. So I also did want to point out that my cousin was also murdered in a mass shooting on December 14th in Aurora, Colorado, back in 1993 at a Chuck E. Cheese. So this has been on my mind, and it's been associated with my birthday for a long time.
I'm so sorry. And how old was your cousin at that time?
She was 19 years old.
While we're sharing gun stories, I'm much older than you. But when I was in high school in the early 70s, I had a friend whose parents lived in Overland Park, and they had gone out of town. It was a holiday weekend, and I went over there. And we're standing in the kitchen, and she opens a drawer and takes out a gun, a shiny gun. And I was shocked because I'm one of the lucky ones. There were not guns in my home. And she wanted me to touch it. And I was like, okay, no thanks. And so that just goes to show you, Jen, what it is you're working on. 15-year-olds, if they have access to a gun, they're going to hand it to another 15-year-old. And let's say a few words about what can happen and what the statistics show happen.
Yeah, so I actually have, there's a mom and dad that are in our group in Moms Demand Action whose son, Ethan Song, passed away because he was at a friend's house and there was an unsecured gun and there was an unintentional shooting and he lost his life. So they are working on what's called Ethan's Law out in Connecticut in order to prevent these kind of shootings in the future by putting some teeth behind laws to lock up your gun securely. So in households where there are guns that are actually stored properly, there's an 85% lower risk of unintentional shootings. So it really does help a lot to just store your guns locked and unloaded with the ammunition stored and locked separately in your home. That way kids, if they do find a gun, at least there's no ammunition, or if they find ammunition, there's no gun there.
So let's say a few words about the first tenant that you have, secure gun storage. Does that require people, would you ask people to get a locker or a cabinet or simply take the ammunition out?
No, we definitely encourage them to have some sort of lockbox where their guns can go. BeSmart has trigger locks, which is kind of the bare minimum of security that you can do with a gun. But we do recommend a storage locker or a gun safe where it is locked and then the ammunition stored separately in another locked container. I know that there's ways that you can access the gun easily with those, with biometric fingerprints and things like that. So to allay some of the fears that people have about being able to access their gun in a situation quickly, there are gun locks and gun safes out there that are easy to access.
So if a person has their gun locked up in their home, then they store it with a non-loaded gun, is what you suggest.
Yes, absolutely. We would like to see the guns being unloaded, because if you think about the fact that most kids know where the gun is stored, and kids are very, very smart, and they will find where the key is. So if the ammunition is stored separately, it's just another barrier to preventing an unintentional shooting.
You're taking me back again. Kids are smart, and they're diligent to look everywhere for that key, interested. And some kids are very interested in guns. Now, I was not. I didn't want to touch it, but other kids want to have a gun and play with a gun. Do you see that?
Absolutely. I think that it's a curiosity, and then it's also kind of a way to show that they're tough.
It's a power thing.
Right.
So many video games. I was at a holiday party last night, and I've got a grandnephew, and he's only 3 years old. And so he was showing me a ninja game, and he was being a real tough ninja. There were no guns, obviously, but that's just the kind, that's the way they play.
Right, right. The video games are definitely, I'm not going to say that they're responsible for the shootings in America, but they do have this tendency to have kids wanting to act tough.
It's interesting to try to understand, are they tough kids and then they play these games, or are these games intended to make them tough kids?
Yeah, that's a really good question.
But it reinforces that kind of aggressive behavior.
Absolutely.
And football, sports, we're very competitive.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's understandable. We have a history of guns in this country.
Yeah, there's a long history of guns in this country. I actually grew up with guns in my house, and I'm not afraid of guns by any means. And actually, my brother owns guns. He teaches a concealed training course out in Ohio where he lives. So I'm not at all afraid of guns, but I am afraid of guns around my children that are not properly secured. I have seven.
They don't have the science, or they don't have the sense. To know what they're doing with that.
Yeah, my daughter is seven. My middle daughter is seven. I also have a 17-year-old stepdaughter. And then I also have a one-year-old. So the seven-year-old's the one I really harp on, kind of, poor thing, about, you know, what to do if she ever finds a gun. You know, we always ask before she goes over. That's another part that we'll talk about later. We always ask before she goes over to play dates about whether or not there's unsecured guns in the home. And we talk about not going into parents' bedrooms because that's likely where a gun will be stored. So that she knows to just kind of stay away from those hotbed areas.
Right. I feel like the part we're talking about right now is the modeling responsible behavior.
Yes, absolutely.
And so that's on the part of the parents to show respect for guns, to show that guns are not a toy.
Right. Absolutely.
That's a curious thing because guns are toys.
Yeah, my mom actually had a rule when I was growing up that we were not allowed to have toy guns of any kind because we did have real guns in our home. So every gun was supposed to be treated as if it was real. So even if it was a toy gun, we weren't allowed to play with it.
And then guns allow people to try skill. There's other things that can build that same kind of aiming skill and the eye skill. Archery, for example,
right.
Which is a formal sport.
Mm-hmm.
Ping pong,
yeah,
which is a game and competitive
right.
game. So what your organization is asking families to do is unload your guns, lock up your guns, and don't have guns sitting around or brandish them about. Now, let's talk about guns in the vehicle before we leave
right.
secure guns. People have guns in their cars.
Mm-hmm.
What do you suggest? How should those be secured?
There are lock boxes and gun safes that can be put mm-hmm. in a car. I would suggest always keeping them in the trunk in the secured box. Or if you aren't able to do that, to take them out of the car when you leave the vehicle, to take them into your home at night, also to store them properly, because a lot of guns actually get stolen out of vehicles.
It's an interesting problem. It's okay to carry a gun. It's okay to have a gun on you, on your holster. I mean, okay, it's not illegal. It's permitted.
Right.
But this is your recommendation, is that to avoid accidents with guns, it would be much smarter to keep them. Obviously, if you had them on a holster, a shoulder holster or a hip holster, you would have the lock on at a minimum.
Right.
If you had it armed,
mm-hmm.
in a perfect world, I guess you would have it unarmed and locked and in a box.
Right. Unless you're actually using it.
So you're asking people to think about, why do you have guns and what are you using it for?
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. And then there are ways, because I know some people do feel more secure with a gun on their person. There are locking mechanisms that are kind of like sleeves that go over the top of a gun that prevent access to the trigger that are helpful.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I think these things come about because of the high number of accidental shootings.
Right. And we would call them unintentional shootings because they're preventable.
Very smart. And I live in a much smaller town than Kansas City, and I read my paper every day. And hardly a week goes by that there isn't an unintentional shooting.
Right.
Some involving youth, some involving adults, some involving more than one adult. It's a tragedy.
It is a tragedy. So in Kansas, specifically, our Be Smart organization has tracked 3 unintentional shootings for children this year alone, just in 2019, and then 350 nationally. So the unintentional shootings that were in Kansas were from the ages of 3 up to 12, which is crazy. But if you think about how curious a 3-year-old is, it shouldn't be that surprising that if they find a gun, they may end up pulling the trigger just by messing around with it.
Well, some guns can be very complicated, too. And mm-hmm. there's buttons on them, and you don't know what all the buttons do. It's not just simple.
Right.
Here's the trigger.
Right.
So that's another problem, depending upon the type of gun a person has. Your children, I'm not sure anyone would want to train a 3-year-old. Here's how you operate our gun.
Right.
So right. they're not trained.
Right.
And they can push any button.
Yeah, and I don't even know that people think about, because I think you have to be 12 years old to do hunter's education. And so a 3-year-old is not even on the radar for being trained to operate a gun.
So I want to talk about the other parts of your program, asking about the presence of unsecured guns in other homes. My parents did not ask when I went to see my friend. Do you think? And I had no idea. I couldn't have answered. So do you have a suggestion on what to do for when a child goes to a home and hears a gun? Like what do you tell them?
So for my kiddo, like I said, my 7-year-old, I always encourage her to tell an adult if she sees an unsecured gun, or even if she sees a gun in a case, because maybe it has a glass top. She would probably tell immediately, because I've instilled it in her for a long time now of what to do when she sees a gun. I also, I always personally text or call the parents before my child goes over to somewhere. I actually have friends who I do know own guns, but I know and trust that they are secure with their guns before I leave her unattended there. So the normalizing the conversation, I think, is the big key to this ask part of the Be Smart message. So you want to make sure that the conversation, and I know that the first time you do it, it's going to be awkward. I usually start with, I don't have any guns in my home. If you do have guns in your home, are they secured? I don't want it to be a judgmental conversation. I don't want to judge anybody for owning a gun. That's their choice. I just want to see if they are safe with their gun. And then I will make an informed choice as a parent about whether or not my child is allowed to play there.
And so the prompt is, people, you can certainly contact the parents of children you invite over. And when you say, oh, hey, we got a new puppy, can your child come over?
Right.
And say, we don't have guns, or if you do have guns, we have our guns secured.
Correct.
So that even without being asked, you can offer, and people can be aware. Now, does that make a problem to be talking to children a lot about guns? The gun shootings that we have, that children do it, say like the Sandy Hook, the mother had a gun. That's what the evidence shows.
Right.
And the child shooter was aware that the mother had a gun.
Right.
Is there any evidence of how that, why
he did it?
Or? Yeah.
So, no, and we don't necessarily focus on the whys. We focus on the prevention. We want to get to it before there is a reason to ask the why. So in the there is an 85% of the school ground shootings that are performed by children or shot. The shooters are children. 85% of those guns came from the home of the shooter or at the home of a relative or friend. So keeping your guns secure prevents those kinds of school shootings, like the Adam Lanza shooting that happened in Newtown, Connecticut on December 14th, 2012. The 85% of the kids couldn't have gotten those guns if they had been locked properly and stored correctly.
Okay, so do you want to say that again? Is you're all about prevention.
Right.
And that was the problem in the Sandy Hook, too.
Exactly.
The gun was not locked up.
Right. And that's the case in majority of these shootings.
Right. It's a shocking. It's hard to to think about.
Right.
So then whether there's a reason, which obviously there is no reason to take a gun to school, but it's the access to guns that are making the problem. So we've discussed accidental shootings, purposeful, as it were, when you're underage,
right.
Shootings. And then there's a role in suicide. So there's a number of children that use guns to harm themselves. Is this what you find?
Yeah, absolutely. So the suicide risk for fatality is pretty minimal when we're talking about any other means of suicide. So only 5% of any other means are fatal in suicide attempts. But when a gun is introduced, 85% of those attempts become fatal.
Or if not fatal, just so terrible, the person...
Right. The other 15% are, you know, it's not an easy recovery.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's so sad. So you have an upcoming event that you wanted to share with us, Jen?
Yes. On December 14th, there will be a vigil for gun violence on 34th and State Line in Kansas City. Right there straddling the Kansas and Missouri line, and it's going to be an inter-group vigil between Kansas City, Kansas moms and Kansas City, Missouri moms. So Johnson County, Wyandotte County, and then the KCMO moms.
I took a look at the map to see the name of the building. Do you know the name of the building there?
No, I don't know it.
Okay, but it's on the Kansas side.
They'll be on all four corners, so it should be on all. Yeah.
Okay, so anybody can go and they'll see the vigil.
Yep.
And there's candles provided.
Yes, there will be candles provided, and we'll have signs just so that people know what we are standing there for. But it is a pretty respectful vigil for people who have died by gun violence.
Well, people, I think that vigils are increased. I think the importance of them are increased by numbers. So I do encourage all our listeners to go and stand. We see this repeatedly.
Yeah.
I don't think that was probably, Sandy Hook was not even the first.
No.
And so we just see it repeatedly.
Yeah.
And come to meetings. Now, when do you all have meetings?
We usually meet on the second Thursday of the month. Our Johnson County group meets at a church in Lenexa, actually. If you want to follow us, you can go to Facebook and do Kansas Moms Demand Action, and then you'll get more details on where the meeting's held.
Yeah, that's good. And in time, you can probably get email from the Moms Demand.
Yes. Because if you sign up, they will definitely send you emails reminding you of where events are upcoming, so you can RSVP and show up to those.
Right. Moms Demand is a national group.
Right.
And so if you go to the website, besmartforkids.org, there's video. There's prompts about talking to your children about guns. There's facts and resources on child firearm suicide, on how to keep your children safe from guns that everyone has a right to have. So I want to thank you, Jen, for being on Jaws of Justice today. This is not the first time we've talked about gun safety, but we have a lot of guns in our society, and they don't wear out. They're not like cars.
Right.
You buy one gun, you've got it for years and years. And
yeah.
It continues to operate. So I thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Now the calendar for the week of December 9th. There will be a Grandparents Against Gun Violence GAGV meeting today, Monday, 12/9 at 4 p.m. at Colonial Church, 7039 Mission Road in Prairie Village, Kansas. Discussion at the meeting will be about the high cost of suicides in our nation and that more deaths from guns this year so far than the number of days in the year. All are welcome. Meet in the basement, east side of the church. Never Again Midwest Action is having an action on Tuesday, December 12th at 11 a.m. for people opposed to the criminalization of immigrants. They're going after ICE with a national wave anchored by simultaneous actions, one in Rhode Island at Wyatt Detention Center and the other in Kansas City at UMB Bank. UNB Bank is earning profits from the imprisonment of immigrants across the country at 11 a.m. at Oppenheimer Brothers Park on 12th and Walnut. You can go to neveragainaction.com/KC on Facebook. There will also be a training before the event for those who can attend Monday, 12/9 at 7 p.m. at Equal Minded Cafe, 4327 Troost, KC Mo. The weekly Willow Domestic Center drop-in at the Lawrence Public Library, 707 Vermont, Lawrence, Kansas, will be held Thursday, December 12th, 9 a.m. to noon. Please stop by for assistance with domestic violence. Also on Thursday, December 12th, there will be a vigil to end gun violence sponsored by Moms Demand Action Kansas at 6:30 p.m. at the Plymouth Congregational Church, 925 Vermont, Lawrence, Kansas, 66044. You can join in song, word, and deed to honor the 500,000 Americans injured or killed by guns since December 12, 2012. On Saturday, December 14th, there will be a holiday toy and gift drive from 12 to 2 p.m. at Equal Minded Cafe, 4327 Troost, KCMO. Real Justice Network supporters and friends are joining to organize a first annual toy and gift drive and networking event. At the event, there will be a quick review of their work over the past 12 months. The drive will focus on the families that have been part of the KC Mama's Day bailout who have spent the last several months dealing with legal issues. You can bring donations of toys, gifts, warm weather items, gift cards, food packages, and the like to this drive. If your group, church, or organization would like to adopt a bailout mama and her family, please email reaelejustice17@gmail.com. Mothers of incarcerated sons and daughters will have their monthly meeting Saturday, December 14th from noon to 2 p.m. at the Waldo Branch Library, 201 East 75th Street, KCMO. If you have loved ones that are incarcerated and need advice and support, MISD has members that may be able to help. Sandy Hook Vigil, a.k.a. National Vigil for Victims of Gun Violence, KC, will be 5:30 to 7 p.m. December 14th at State Line Crossroads, 43rd and State Line, Kansas City, Kansas. Volunteers of Missouri Moms Demand Action, Kansas, Moms Demand Actions, and Students Demand Action will ask all to join to honor Sandy Hook elementary victims and survivors. Candles will be provided. My name is Elise, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org.
This is Jeff Humfeld. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio. The image of jail or prison that most people have is one that has been fed to them by the news and entertainment media and politicians. That image ranges from three hots in a cot to scenes of violence by inmates against inmates or guards, or maybe even going crazy and solitary. On Jaws of Justice Radio, we have given you glimpses behind the walls through the eyes of those that have been there or are there now. You would think that the last thing any of the formerly incarcerated would want to do is go back there. And you would be right. We have brought you a fair amount of information of how a discrimination leads to a failure to reintegrate into society. But that failure starts inside the walls and inside the individual. Today, we are going to talk to Ricky Kidd, who has spent over 20 years in prison for a crime he did not commit. We will focus on his story of perseverance and triumph over the barriers and degradations of incarceration. Ricky found talents within himself and has used them to be a positive example to others behind the walls. Welcome back to Jaws of Justice Radio, Ricky.
Hey, thank you, Jeff.
Please give us a brief update about your case and where you're at right now.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me again. It's always good to be with you. My case is currently in the Missouri Supreme Court's pending a ruling to determine whether the judge here in Jackson County can hear my claims of innocence, or if I would have to return to DeKalb County and have a judge to hear my case out there. And so we're waiting. January 10th, we had oral arguments. It's going almost into 60 days. March 6th, I believe, is the next regular hand-down date. Hopefully a decision is in there for us, and hopefully it is favorable to stay here, because leaving at this juncture, which is almost 3 years into the process, would essentially start me over. So that's kind of where we're at there, keeping our prayers up and our fingers crossed.
You've been pretty busy while you were incarcerated. Why don't you tell us how you found some of the talents that you have and what you've been doing to keep yourself busy and productive?
I mean, going back, one of the first things I did was ask myself, how did I get here? And that was a real important question from a point of my innocence, and as well as from the aspect of my decision-making in life. Like, although I was innocent, what decisions was I making that even put me in such a vulnerable position in the first place? And so I started taking a hard look at that early in my first year. My first and second year, I started taking a hard look at that, which led me to started taking classes. And so I took advantage of all prison programs. Once I started taking classes and I understood them, I then began to teach them. Then that experience allowed me to begin to create programs. And so I started creating programs of my own that the administration would approve and allow us to proceed with. Something I also did was I strengthened my communication and leadership skills through prison organizations, various Toastmasters programs, the NAACP inside the institutions. Those organizations allowed me to learn parliamentary procedures, how to speak, how to find my voice, and things of that nature. They also, the administration allowed me to sit on various inmate council committees that consisted of wardens and other section heads. That helped me also find my voice. And second half to that is where I began writing and producing plays, which the administration gave me the platform to do so. I was grateful for that. And Jeff, one brick piled up on the other, which led to privileged jobs. Like, they gave me a job in the video production unit. And there, the warden allowed me to create and host internal TV programs. The prison had their own internal TV programs. And so I was able to produce a show called Kids Corner, Let's Talk, Prison Cuisine. Just taking full advantage of the opportunities that the prison allowed, or working with them and creating new opportunities. And then lastly, when the Puppies for Parole program came to the institution, the dog training program, I was among the first eight at Southeast Correctional Center to participate. And each of these gave way to significant personal growth and allowed me to matter, even in the midst of what some would call my misery.
All right, let's talk a little bit about some of the plays that you've written. When I was looking through some of the information that I had gotten from you in the past, I came across two plays that I didn't realize I had copies of them.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about the plays that you have, and I think there's one of them that's maybe going to be produced again here soon, here in Kansas City?
Sure, absolutely. And so I Want to Be Like My Father was one of the first plays that I did inside the institution. It's about gentleman, inner city gentleman who was void of a father figure, ripping and running the streets, and was making poor choices. It's a gospel play that focuses on our Heavenly Father as being the role model. And so that was a play that the administration allowed me. The chaplain, Steve Johnson, there, he really trusted me and allowed me full reign to put my hands in on that, to pick the cast, to practice for about 8 or 9 weeks. We was able to put on the play. Outside people began to hear about the play. They started coming in. It really turned out to be real nice. In fact, that play is on YouTube. It can be found on YouTube right now under I Want to Be Like My Father or My Name Ricky Kidd. That kind of gave me the bug a little. And the next play that the chaplain allowed me to do was Not On My Own, which was about a young guy who was, 24-year-old guy who was dealing with the diagnosis of leukemia, and he was trying to go at it alone. it symbolizes what we all go through, not necessarily a diagnosis of leukemia, but any problems that life throws us, we don't have to go at it alone as far as people around us who love us. And, of course, it was spiritual-based, too, that we always have our spiritual Father in heaven. And so that led me to Purpose in Your Pain, which was another play they allowed me to do. That's just about finding purpose inside whatever you're going through. A lot of times, even my own situation has been quite painful, and what helped me was finding purpose in it. Kind of like the kid who's about to get a shot or at the dentist and a sucker or something distracts him a little. It eases the pain. So when I was able to focus on my purpose, it eased the pain and it allowed me to produce Purpose in Your Pain. But the play you're talking about coming up here March 13th in the Westport area, it's called Mind of the Innocent. And Mind of the Innocent is about what it's like to be wrongfully, a young man who is dealing with the emotional aspect of being wrongfully convicted, using spoken words, which I also write, to depict dark days, happy days, in-between days. And so those are some of the plays that I've had the privilege to produce, thanks to the wardens at various institutions that gave me favor.
Back in 2012, the St. Louis American, they did a feature on you and how you started a greeting card company. So you've branched out not just into theater, and we'll get into the poetry here in a little bit, but into actually artwork and all. Where did you find this within yourself?
Yeah, I had met a young gentleman who was very, very, very strong in his art ability, his ability to draw, and we partnered together and began to collect his images. He would spit them out like water, and they was all different. I mean, they were very unique and different. He couldn't even duplicate the same piece. If somebody wanted him to do it again, he couldn't. That's just how unique this gentleman was. And so we collected the pieces over the course of a year. He drew the cards. I wrote. I matched the words with the card. We partnered with Harriet Clark, a good friend of ours, both of ours, on the outside, and we created Humble Standards greeting cards. And the idea was to make it a social structured business where we can give back to various social causes that all three of us cared about. And so, yeah, the St. Louis American caught wind of that and did a piece that highlighted some of the things that we was doing or was trying to do with Humble. Humble still hasn't matured all the way, but I'm very optimistic about, upon my release, that I can get back to that and maybe bring it to a level of productivity and profitability. So,
one of the things that you did send me quite some time ago was a resume of all the different things that you've been involved in, and that's everything from hospice care to, like you say, teaching classes and other such things. Why don't you tell us some of the activities that you were engaged in that were the most significant to your turning your life around and finding a positive path?
Sure. Jeff, although I kept a continued fight to prove my innocence, I knew what the odds were. And I believe only 1% of appeals were successful. I may have to check that, but it's a very low percentage. And so I'm swimming upstream here to prove my innocence. And the reality is I may be successful, I may not. And I came to the conclusion that if I had to spend my life in prison, I wanted it to be a meaningful existence. And if I was successful on my appeal, then I wanted to be the opposite of the person I was when I came in, worthy of all the work that was being put in on my behalf and proving my innocence. And so focusing on my freedom was very, very significant and important, but also my growth and development. And so it went hand in hand. My work, my 22 years, may it be 22 years that I've been incarcerated this year, but I wanted it to matter one way or the other. Again, whether I was unsuccessful on my appeals, I still and had to do the rest of my life in prison. I wanted it to be meaningful, the most meaningful existence. And if I was granted my deserving freedom, I wanted it to be successful and meaningful. So the path that I've chartered and the resume that you're talking about, it's a reflection that allows me to be me and have some sort of life, whether I win or whether I lose.
It's time to remind you that you are listening to Jaws of Justice Radio on KKFI. My name is Jeff Humfeld, and I am speaking with Ricky Kidd. One of the things that the resume doesn't really show is the effect that you've had on others. So your growth is personal, of course, but it's also the example for others, and you mentor and work with others to help them see that they have more inside them as well. Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. Very, 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 very important to me to be able to look outside of myself. And so, but Jeff, I want to say this. Malcolm X once said that opportunity is usually a place for gestation, which is growth and development. So, yeah, the atmosphere here can be right if one so chooses. Life slows down. One is exposed to a form of structure inside prison, which many of us probably lack on the outside. And in my opinion, time, to some extent, becomes your friend. Which gives way to soul searching, it gives way to excavation, it gives way to perspective, to study. And given that, I think from the last study I read, 85% of crimes have some connection with addiction or drugs and alcohol use, prison or jail gives you that space to clean up and sort of rewire yourself. So prison and jail are bad places, no doubt about it. But there's also a silver lining, depending on what you're looking for. Stripped of social status, brand, clothing, and materialistic things. Essentially, when you come here, you're left without, rather, you're left with just yourself. And if you look there, you'll find the real you. I know for me, I did. So this might not be a bad situation if we know how to make it good for us.
Last year, we had you on talking about your book of poetry, Vivid Expressions, and while your plays tended to be spiritual, the poetry really is very much you and what you felt and how you've dealt with the setbacks and everything else that's happened to you.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about the poetry, how it's being received, and you know, if there's a way folks can actually get a copy of the book, where they would find it.
Sure. I started writing poetry as when I first came down in the early years for therapeutic purposes, emotions, expressions, that was important for me to get out on paper. I just continued to write throughout the year. I took a hiatus from poetry and got heavily involved in programs for about 10 years, and then I came back to it in about 2013, and up to now I'm still writing, even as I'm here in Jackson County. And so I was able to pull all those pieces together and compile it where we came out with the book Vivid Expressions, A Journey Inside the Mind of the Innocents. And what Vivid Expressions does for a reader is it allows you to enjoy poetry as an art, but it also tells a story, what it's like to be wrongfully convicted. And so that came out last August 2017. I haven't really pushed it hard. The idea was to just kind of like an appetizer, in a sense, to get people an idea of what it's like to be inside prison and what it's like to go through this. But I think upon my reintegration, I look to do book tours and then speak, because it's really spoken words that more so of the truth. It's less poetry and more spoken words, and so the feel is different. I hope to put out, I'm working with, last year I started working with Orlando Peoples, who is a Grammy Award winning producer, with him and the gospel artist Lecrae won a Grammy in 2014. And so I've really been privileged to work with him. We started communication in the project where we're going to turn Vivid Expressions into a spoken words album. If he's in the process, though, some of those pieces are already recorded, and he's in the process of mixing them up, and hopefully that'll be coming out here soon, where we could just continue to promote the book and the album together.
You've turned lemons into lemonade, so to say, for yourself. You know, you found talents within yourself that you probably didn't know you had before you ended up in prison. Do you think that you would have found these talents if you'd been on the outside and been living a different life?
No, I don't. I just have to be frank and honest. I don't, because I'm just not sure. When I look at the moment of my wrongful incarceration, that space, I hadn't found myself. And I'm not sure what would have happened or what atmosphere or right people I would have came in contact with that would allow me to do so. So, but prison, as awful as it has been, it triggered something inside me that made me soul search and find my gifts and my talents and my purpose and my meaning. So I'm just not sure. I want to say no, but really I'm just not sure.
One of the things that you do is you mentor or you tutor guys in life skills. That's one of the things that you did in the programs, but it's also something you do on a one-on-one level. Do you think that all of these inmates or most of these inmates, whether they were guilty or innocent or whatever, has within them the ability to find that positive path if they can overcome the barriers and the blockages that are there within prison? And are there changes that the institutions could make that would help encourage inmates to find that positive path and grow?
I do. You know, Jeff, I found that most men live, these individuals that we incarcerate live on their outer shell, or this outer self of who they are and not their inner self. I've developed the ability to be able to see past the aura or the facade or the personas. And then what I've also noticed to your question is they lack programming, literally. If you and I both had a computer and mine's had the most updated program and the software, then mine's just going to be able to do differently from what yours can do. And what we assume or take for granted is that these men have had the right mental programming, whether that's conflict resolution, whether that's anger management, whether that's goals. A lot of the individuals did not even understand goals, short-term, mid-term, intermediate, long-term. They don't even understand these concepts and these principles that really society is structured and based upon. They don't know how to fill out a resume. They don't know how to build a resume. They don't know how to do job interviews. Some of them don't even know reading and comprehension, and that was one of the most disturbing things that I found. They talk real slick and fast and clever, but you put a book in front of them or something of that nature, and they're struggling. When I used to teach classes and hand out homework, they couldn't complete their homework. And so subsequently, I worked with some of the teacher volunteers at Charleston. And we was able to create a literary program to help these guys. The NAACP I was involved in, they also began to create a tutor program where we was able to help these guys. But to your point, prison can be more helpful, the institution itself or jail, by recognizing these voids or these black holes in these individuals' lives and begin to try to fulfill them in a more aggressive way. I'm not saying that the Department of Corrections doesn't have programs, but what I found is they're kind of like coffee water. They're not real strong. It looks like coffee. It's dark in color, but it's not strong at all. And so I think there's things they can do to make their program stronger and to bring more programs to the institutions and jails.
One of the things that comes to my mind is you've been doing these type things a good deal of the time that you've been behind bars. Surely you have run into others who are doing similar work. Have you seen that within others, that, you know, for them it isn't just their own personal journey, but it's actually sharing that journey with others and trying to bring them along down the same path?
I've seen it. I'm not sure that I've seen many as passionate about it as I am, but I think there are individuals who do look outside themselves and try to bring the next individual along. I'm not sure that others are as gifted as I am, and I say that humbly. Our gifts and our talents, in my opinion, come from above, so it's nothing that I've done our skills develop and create, but our gifts come from above, and so I've seen them. You know, other guys get involved and try to do programs and pull other people's up. There's some of us are rare in nature. I think you and I had a conversation before about Alvin Kersey Bay. who was another one of those individuals who was rare. So are there individuals doing it? Yeah. Are they doing it at the highest level or the most passionate level, the most involved level? I think there's a rare number of us doing it on that level. So.
You mentioned Alvin, and I have to say Alvin's and looked outside of himself, not just behind the bars, but once he got out, he actually was one of the people that helped start this radio show. And I can say that, that he touched me personally, and the way that I approach life. I learned a great deal from Alvin in a very short time, and I really, he's someone that I miss dearly. He's passed on now.
And so those type of guys impact, they, you don't see that a lot at that level. It's the Michael Jacksons of music. It's the Whitney Houstons of music. Not that these other artists aren't great or doing great things, but to me, I think Alvin Kersey Bay is in a category of his own, and for me, that's an area that I'm striving towards.
Ricky, we thank you for being on today.
Sure. Thank you, Jeff. It's always a pleasure.
It's the 420 Drug War News. Mr. Howard Josepher.
The work I have done for many years is help inner-city substance users, people coming out of prison, people living with or at risk for HIV, and generally hardcore drug misusers.
Sure. Now, we're speaking with Mr. Howard Josepher, a long-term, I guess, lifetime resident of New York City, been involved up there for decades, and helping to save lives and futures and possibilities. Is that a good summation?
Yes, it is a good summation.
Tell us a bit about some of the organizations and the processes that made those that progress possible.
Well, I'm a person who's got a long long memory and a long experience in the substance misuse and drug treatment field. I overcame my own addiction to heroin 50 years ago by being coerced to go into a newly formed program called Phoenix House and do something about my drug habit. That turned out to be a great opportunity and it did turn my life around. I was about 30. Since then, I've gone back to school, became a clinical social worker in New York State. I worked as a consultant in many drug programs and started my own private practice, which I've been doing now for 40-some-odd years. But I took on a piece of consulting work in 1988 at the height of the AIDS epidemic, when we were first becoming aware of what was happening in the injecting drug-using community. Till that point, there was absolutely no attempt to engage them other than a few clandestine needle exchange programs. So there was a research study that a group of researchers in New York obtained from the National Institute on Drug Abuse to create an experimental model, deliver that model to the intended target, which was people who were coming out of prison and inject drugs, a vulnerable population, they felt. And they wanted us to create this model, put how many people we could within the 3-year time frame that this grant was awarded, and see what happens in our ability to modify or change their behaviors.
I am Dean at DrugTruth.net.
Sitting here in my prime, what am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow. Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio. not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.